Hello and welcome to No Character Limit. My name is Robert Thurk, and today you're going to hear episode 24 of my book entitled Ultima Thule, Unraveling the Unknown. This is the first of four episodes dedicated to chapter 15 called The Big Ones. In the last few chapters, I've talked a lot about meteorites, the different kinds of meteorites, meteors from comets, and the value of meteorites on Earth. In the last episode, I told the story of the Karankos meteorite and how a large amount of people likely somaticized, having symptoms due to the shock of the power of the landing. Something similar also happened in Chelyabinsk, Russia, which I touched on in the last episode as well. But this chapter is focused on some of the biggest landfalls or impact events the Earth has ever experienced. And today we're going to start out actually pretty small as far as extraterrestrial landings go. But I'm also beginning this chapter with one of the most mysterious impact events in modern memory. So much so that it has captured imaginations for over a century and technically hasn't been definitively proven to be a meteorite impact because there technically is no evidence for it. What I'm talking about is, of course, the Tunguska event. This entire episode is dedicated to this intriguing anomaly that happened deep in the taiga of Siberia, not far from where the original Pallas Iron was found, but far more remote. Since I was a kid, I've heard stories swirl around the Tunguska event, and it was always picked up on by shows delving into unsolved mysteries, supernatural phenomena, and possibly even related to aliens. So I wanted to set out to find what do we actually know and dive into each of the leading theories to see how much evidence each is basing their claim on. So, naturally, once again, questions about sources and what makes someone or something more trustworthy come into play in both this episode, but also in the next episode in particular. What sort of people are involving themselves in provocative mysteries like the Tunguska event for personal profit over the truth? It's hard to say for certain, but be on the lookout for discussions on honest scientific sources over the next couple of episodes. Before we get into this episode, though, I just want to mention that we are finally coming close to the end of Ultima Thule. Chapter 15 is the penultimate chapter of the book, and it looks like, since it's going to take four episodes to get through, the last chapter is only likely going to need two episodes. So I just wanted to give you an idea of where we are on the trip we've been on together getting through this book. I appreciate anybody who has listened to each episode so far, because this is the whole point of why I wrote it to begin with. So, of course, the normal housekeeping things. If you've been enjoying this podcast, you can always donate. I always appreciate that. For any size donation, I give a free PDF copy of the book. In this chapter, specifically this episode related to the Tunguska event, I've got some great images that were taken of the event during the initial discoveries of it, as well as diagrams, maps, and some beautiful images of the taiga. Of course, if you just enjoy listening, you can always like, rate, or review, or tell a friend to help spread the word of the podcast. Please follow me at nocharacterlimit@mastodon.world. And finally, you can always reach out to me at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again if you've been listening through this entire book so far, but with no further ado, let's break into chapter 15, The Big Ones. Chapter 15, The Big Ones. Part 1, The Mysterious Tunguska Event. The traumatic disorientation caused by an unknown and unexpected phenomenon, like a meteorite impact, can easily trick the mind into ascribing supernatural or divine effects to it, as it likely did in Carrancas, especially when it's as large as the one that happened in Chelyabinsk in 2013. But no meteor event in recent history is as mysterious or as large as what is remembered as the Tunguska event. On June 30th, 1908, seismometers around the world recorded an unusually powerful earthquake picked up in faraway places like Washington, D.C., London, Berlin, and St. Petersburg. The strength of the one-time reading clearly came from somewhere deep in the taiga of eastern Siberia, somewhere hundreds of miles north between Krasnoyarsk and Lake Baikal, two of Russia's distant Siberian outposts. Whatever caused the seismometers to jump had to have been powerful, with readings that rivaled the largest earthquakes on Earth. In the days following the unusual tremor, there were brilliant sunsets reported across Europe, with an eerie glow in the night sky for several days following the mysterious detection, which were reported to be so bright that people in Paris could read newspapers, and Londoners could even take pictures well after the sun had set. The light is said to have come from clouds so high up in the atmosphere that they reflected sunlight from the other side of the Earth onto its night side. So, what could cause the Earth to shake so violently and the sky to show so eerily bright after dark? The Tunguska event captures the mind today, just as it did over a century ago, and is often associated with wild speculation that veers quickly into the realm of superstition and the paranormal. It has been mentioned in Indiana Jones, Star Trek, X-Files, Ghostbusters, and even an Isaac Asimov story. explanations of what happened in that Siberian wilderness on that June morning have ranged from a UFO crash to an electromagnetic weapon explosion created by Nikola Tesla. Like the locals of Carrancas, people have attempted to fill the void of a mystery on that day with fantastic speculation to accompany a fantastic occurrence. The Tunguska event is one of the biggest unsolved mysteries on Earth, which is made all the more enticing because it is one of the most powerful blasts that have ever been recorded by humans. Even though it's over a century since the event, a definite cause has not been fully proven. And because of this, even implausible theories work to compete against the much more likely theories. But until definitive evidence is found by a reliable source, baseless speculation will continue to compete with more solid theories. What makes the Tunguska event even more difficult to understand is that there is often different and conflicting information when it has been reported on, even by reliable sources. The first problem with Tunguska is that the event wasn't investigated by any scientist in the immediate aftermath, despite the seismometers registering it. It wasn't until 1921, 13 years after the event, that one scientist was tasked with a 2-year mission to track the reports of a brilliant fireball that was visible over a vast area, moving from approximately south to north, and was accompanied by deafening explosions and a great trembling of the ground when it struck Earth in June of 1908. The scientist chosen for the job was one of the few in the world that had successfully tracked down a meteorite already. His name was Leonid Kulik. Kulik was a World War I veteran that quickly found success in the newly crystallizing Soviet government of Russia due to his arrest history of joining revolutionary activities against the Tsar. He had studied meteoritics, and when tasked with hunting down a meteorite in 1918, he returned with a chondrite that weighed over 250 pounds. The director of the meteorite section of the Mineralogical Museum of the Academy of Sciences in Petrograd knew that if anyone was going to figure out the cause of what was spotted over Siberia back in 1908, that it would be Kulik. What followed for Kulik was the Siberian equivalent of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, as he traveled from one place to the next, thinking that he had finally found the potential location of the crash site, only to learn another clue and realize that he had to travel ever deeper into the mystical taiga of Siberia. Finally, he learned that it landed beyond the Podkamennaya Tunguska River, a location so remote that he was not able to reach it during his allotted 2-year trip. Once again, the Tunguska event eluded understanding. But Kulik was not ready to give up yet. He was driven to find the cause, but after his 2 years were up, He knew he had to set the hunt aside for now to focus on his scientific studies on meteorites. Over the next several years, Kulik traveled across Russia and focused on teaching people to identify meteorites, creating a network of people who would send potential meteorite samples to the Mineralogical Museum to be identified. This alone would have made Kulik a hero to the meteoritical community. But by 1927, nearly 2 decades after the Tunguska event occurred, and 6 years after his original search, Kulik was ready to try to find the cause once again. He began by slogging his way out to the town of Vanavera, a small village on the banks of the Podkamennaya Tunguska River. Vanavera is located along the same latitude as Anchorage, Alaska, making the temperature, on average, negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit. This was Krasnoyarsk territory, not far, relatively speaking at least, to where Pallas had found his famous iron over a century earlier, kickstarting the entire branch of meteoritic science. Even today, Vanavera remains detached from the modern world, as a search on Google Maps reveals multiple abandoned wooden structures, streets made of dirt, and paths made of pallet to stay above the storied and treacherous Siberian mud. The small town is surrounded everywhere by the taiga, with thousands of miles of untouched pines, spruces, and larches. Today, Vanavera is the largest village of a much larger surrounding region, which only holds about 400 people. Kulik traveled through the same place over 100 years ago, then only a fur trading station, in search of what caused that mysterious explosion. To travel through the wilderness, Kulik used sleds, rafts, horses, and even rode on the back of a reindeer. Kulik knew where to go because he relied on his local guides, a nomadic people who lived in this region known as the Evenk, who remain the dominant inhabitants of Vanavera today, just as they were back then. The Evenk had found a way to live in the swampy, muddy, mosquito-filled forests that went into a deep freeze in the winter and shrouded the region with disorienting snowstorms. They survived because they were expert hunters and fishermen who found natural mosquito repellents and used snowshoes in the winter. The Evenk taught the Russians how to survive in the largest forest in the world, even as the Russians claimed ownership over it, taxed them, and threatened harm if they didn't pay up. The Evenk specialized in raising domesticated reindeer, a special breed which differed significantly from the wild reindeer that roamed the endless taiga. While the Evenk would hunt or kill wild reindeer, they would only use their domesticated reindeer for milk and transportation. The Evenk would have a saddle that would go over the front shoulders of the reindeer, and They used a stick for balance rather than stirrups. This is how Kulik made his way into the Siberian hinterlands, trekking into a wilderness without trails in hopes to find evidence of a 2-decade-old meteor. This time, Kulik's trip into the taiga was not in vain, as the Evenk showed him what they called the Cursed Forest. Kulik found countless trees knocked completely to the ground, uprooted, and on their backs like matchsticks. Even more, he realized they were all facing the same direction. And this went on for miles. Some claim that the Evenk refused to go any further at this point, and that Kulik needed to return for new guides. But others claim that he was able to find deep water-filled holes in the peat bogs that seemed to be impacts from pieces of the meteorite, and that he wanted to get necessary equipment to drain them, and so he turned back. Either way, Kulik was convinced that he had found the location of the legendary 1908 meteorite and returned on 2 subsequent missions over the next couple of years to further explore this post-apocalyptic site. During these missions, he learned that the trees were all laying on their back in a radial manner, which means that he could easily find the location of the impact by following the pointing trees to their center. But when he got there, Kulik was faced with an even greater surprise than the roughly 80 million trees that had been knocked down in a circle around Ground Zero. In the center of it all, where he expected to find a massive crater, he was instead greeted with trees standing upright without branches or bark, something he called telephone poles. It would take him another decade and a close call with a crash landing in a plane before he could get an aerial view of the site and determine that the total affected area expanded over 150 square miles. When he tried pumping out one of the waterlogged holes that he thought was a small crater, the only thing he found at the bottom was a stump. Ultimately, Kulik would never find any direct evidence of a meteorite impact, leaving Tunguska a greater mystery than ever. The photographs he brought back caused a sensation and still impress today. The amount of force that could knock down so many trees so uniformly must have been awesome. One story claims that Kulik brought a potential rock specimen back that was subsequently lost. But this seems unlikely, as Kulik was one of the world's best meteorite scientists in the early half of the 20th century, and would likely not let such an important rock get lost. While he would never be able to conquer the enigma of Tunguska, he would go on to find more meteorites through instrumental calculation, the first person ever to do so. He held high-ranking positions and was recognized for his role as a leading scientist in the area of meteoritics. and when World War II broke out, even after being allowed to sit out of the war due to weak eyesight, the old veteran joined a local militia and was ultimately captured by the Nazis, where he assisted in medical-related work before dying of typhus in 1942. Kulik's expedition to the Tunguska site has been the most relied-upon evidence to date as to what actually happened on that day over 3 decades before his death. The eyewitness accounts that Kulik collected offer the most revealing glimpse into what happened on that fateful Siberian morning on June 30th, 1908. It's claimed that it was difficult for Kulik to collect these accounts, since many of the Evank were unwilling to talk about it, and may even have felt it to be their responsibility to keep it hidden. Just as some locals in Karankas thought that it was a mythical creature that created such powerful damage, there was a belief among the Evank that the event of 1908 was a punishment from their sky god for disagreements between their tribes. But Kulik's eyewitness testimonies continue to be the best descriptions on what actually happened on that day. From a distance of about 250 miles away from the center of the blast, people claim to see a ball of fire coming down obliquely. They said as it approached the ground, it took on a flattened shape, and that they saw a flying star with a fiery tail. Its tail disappeared into the air. But the key eyewitness accounts came from much closer to the event that they are worth recounting in full. The Vannevera Trading Post was within 40 miles of the blast, and 2 witnesses recounted what happened that day. The first said, quote, "I was sitting on the porch of the house at the trading station, looking north. Suddenly, in the north, the sky was split in two, and high above the forest, the whole northern part of the sky appeared covered with fire. I felt a great heat, as if my shirt had caught fire. At that moment, there was a bang in the sky and a mighty crash. I was thrown 20 feet from the porch and lost consciousness for a moment. The crash was followed by a noise like stones falling from the sky, or guns firing. The earth trembled. At the moment when the sky opened, a hot wind, as if from a cannon, blew past the huts from the north. It damaged the onion plants. Later, we found that many panes in the windows had been blown out, and the iron hasp on the barn door had been broken." End quote. The second witness relayed, quote, "I saw the sky in the north open to the ground and fire poured out. The fire was brighter than the sun. We were terrified, but the sky closed again, and immediately afterward, bangs like gunshots were heard. We thought stones were falling. I ran with my head down and covered because I was afraid stones may fall on it." End quote. But those at the trading post at Vannevera were not the closest witnesses that Kulik received accounts from. Evank reindeer herders that were within 20 miles of the blast and camping in tents were twice as close as those at Vannevera. The testimonies from these individuals, according to Kulik, provide the closest experience of the Tunguska event from anybody who lived to tell about it. One witness said, quote, "Early in the morning, when everyone was asleep in the tent, it was blown up in the air along with its occupants. Some lost consciousness. When they regained consciousness, they heard a great deal of noise and saw the forest burning around them, much of it devastated." End quote. Another account relayed, quote, "The ground shook and incredibly prolonged roaring was heard. Everything round about was shrouded in smoke and fog from burning, falling trees. Eventually, the noise died away and the wind dropped, but the forest went on burning. Many reindeer rushed away and were lost." End quote. It is alleged that hundreds of reindeer were killed, and one man was even launched up into a tree, breaking his arm, and later dying. However, there are no known accounts of anyone who died directly from the blast. The blast experienced by those Evenk reindeer herders or those at the Vannevera trading post share qualities and characteristics of a nuclear blast decades before nuclear technology existed. That the blast was so powerful at ground zero that it stripped the bark and branches from the trees but left the trunks themselves still standing has only been witnessed at sites like Hiroshima after the bomb was dropped. The hot winds and level of noise indicate a high likelihood that what these people saw was a powerful meteor in the sky, just as Kulik suspected. NASA's article about the Tunguska event says that it was likely a large space rock about 120 feet across that detonated in the sky. The mass of rock likely weighed about 220 million pounds and approached the Earth at speeds of around 33,000 miles per hour. Then, the bolide heated up to about 44,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and the combination of pressure and heat caused the asteroid to fragment and annihilate itself, producing a fireball and releasing energy equivalent to about 185 Hiroshima bombs. The amount of Hiroshima bombs that Tunguska released seems to be a topic of debate, but it's unanimously agreed that the Tunguska event was many times greater than the first nuclear attack. The ground around the center of the Tunguska event was left in the shape of shock waves, like waves of an ocean suddenly frozen as Earth. Kulik's belief that a meteor was the cause of Tunguska still remains the strongest theory today. But without an impact site at ground zero and without definitive meteorite pieces, other explanations have competed with Kulik's well-reasoned theory. One of the most extreme theories about what happened at Tunguska that has at least some academic backing is that it was caused by a dark matter collision. Gunther Kletechka from Charles University in Prague has actually traveled out to the site 100 years after the event and still found dead trees uprooted and on their side in the taiga. He has actually taken core samples from the trees that survived the blast and has analyzed them to find high levels of calcium. Calcium is typically only found in the bark of trees, but Kletechka was finding the element deep inside the core of the tree. Kletechka surmises that this is related to the blast waves pushing tree fluids into their interior, but has difficulty explaining any further meaning beyond that. Kletechka has given interviews and has made posts on the Institute of Geology of the Czech Academy of Sciences, stressing that we still don't know what happened. He goes further, stating, quote, "We have data supporting that this explosion can be the result of a collision between the Earth and an object made out of black matter," end quote. He points to theoretical calculations and magnetization patterns from samples that indicate that black matter could be the real culprit. Kletechka is not the only one entertaining this theory either, as other scientific papers have been published in scientific journals proposing the theory of a dark matter ball as the cause of the event. Another of the more implausible theories is that it was a massive outflow of natural gas from a kimberlite pipe that connects deep into the mantle of the Earth. Kimberlite pipes are often what bring diamonds to the surface. With this theory, it's believed that a large natural gas plume reaching all the way to the exosphere somehow ignited, and then the flames raced back down to the ground where the massive explosion from the kimberlite pipe occurred. If the atmosphere ignited, it could give the visual impression of a meteorite as the flames raced back toward the ground. With Tunguska being located in the Siberian Traps, it may be possible that a kimberlite pipe is located there. However, the amount of concentrated natural gas needed to flood the atmosphere to make this theory plausible is unlike anything that has been known to happen on Earth. Even more, there is inconsistent reporting between the eyewitness accounts and this theory. It's unlikely that a giant natural gas output would take on a similar shape as a meteor entering the atmosphere, which is clearly what is described by the eyewitness accounts. The reports from Vannevera talk about the fear of being rained on by stones suggests a meteor rather than a gas deposit. But of course, if it was a meteor, then where are the meteorites? One theory supposes that it was an icy comet rather than a meteor, and that it would have disintegrated well before it hit the ground. But this theory comes with its own problems, the primary one being that comets are far less likely to hit the Earth than meteors. Another theory claims that a meteor only grazed the atmosphere, causing a shock blast, and then bounced back off into space, something that does occasionally happen from time to time. However, the size of the meteor that could cause that sort of a shock without coming that close to the ground certainly leaves one to question the reliability of this theory as well. In order to confirm this grazer theory, astronomers would need to find a dark asteroid orbiting through space with just the right trajectory, which would be like spotting a speck of dust floating somewhere around the headlamp of a car while you stare directly into it. If this was the case, it may be why the following nights around the world after Tunguska reflected so much light from the sun, as debris and dust from the entrance and exit would be at some of the highest levels of the atmosphere. But a meteor that nearly hits the ground would also have traveled through the same upper atmosphere and left a cloud behind it. This has been confirmed by eyewitnesses during the meteor storms of 1833 and 1966. It's safe to say that, at the very least, the Kimberlite pipe theory and the grazer theory are not the most parsimonious and would need further evidence to make them reliable candidates. One group of Italian scientists made the news when they claimed that a nearby lake in the Taiga, about 5 miles from ground zero of the blast, was an impact crater. Known as Lake Cecco, the Italian team noted that the 1,600-foot lake had not been mapped before the 1908 event, and it was unusually deep for the region. The Italian team claimed that a large chunk of the meteorite broke off and landed where Cecco is now, arguing that Tunguska was two separate bodies when it entered the atmosphere, or shortly thereafter. The biggest clue of all was that there was allegedly a buried stony object at the bottom of the lake. However, Russian scientists followed up and pointed out that it was not unlikely for such a small lake to be overlooked in mapping the remote wilderness of Siberia at the beginning of the 20th century. They also analyzed the sediments at the bottom of the lake to find that it was at least 280 years old. Even more, the Russian team claims there are many other similar lakes in the area, debunking the Italian claim that Cecco is unusual in any way. Despite the tantalizing report of a stony object at the bottom of Cecco, nobody has attempted to dredge it up, if it even really is there at all. But in 2013, another hopeful claim of finding meteorite pieces came up when one Andrei Zlobin from the Russian Academy of Sciences claimed to have found meteorite fragments from the area. He had traveled out to the location directly beneath the air blast in 1988 and collected stone samples at the bottom of the Kuzhmo River, a location where rocks were most likely to collect downstream from the blast. It took Zlobin 20 years to analyze his haul, but ultimately came up with 3 small samples of rocks that have indicated melting from intense heat of falling through the atmosphere. The largest piece is a mere 10 grams, which he called whale, while the other two he named dental crown and boat for how they looked. These could have come from an exploding meteorite or comet, according to Zlobin. But he also admitted that these 3 specimens needed to undergo chemical analysis to bolster his claim. Even if these 3 fragments are of extraterrestrial origin, there's also the possibility that they are not related to Tunguska at all. Even more questions arise when, despite being collected in 1988, these stones were not analyzed for 2 decades and then not reported on in the media for another 5 years after that. Since the 2013 announcement, which was picked up by outlets like MIT Technology Review and Live Science, no further news of chemical analysis has been reported, keeping Tunguska a mystery to this day. The testimonies collected by Kulik have enough corroboration to indicate that this is most likely a meteor that had entered the atmosphere and did not exit again. A ball of fire with a fiery tail that took on a flattened shape as it approached the ground does not indicate that this was a grazer. The taking on a flattened shape is one of the more interesting testimonies. It's possible to imagine a large fiery ball thinning out to something more aerodynamic, like in the case of what happened over Chelyabinsk, where it seemed to go from bright ball to a thin line that disappeared in the sky. A set of paintings by William Hartman of the Planetary Institute imagined it flattening out on the bottom, as if the fireball just disappeared in midair to leave a giant smoke cloud. Another artist, Don Davis, has a giant disintegrating cloud of fire directly over the blast site, making it a point to include the shockwave as it hit the ground. A meteor disintegrating before it hits the ground is so common that it has a special term for it, a bolide. But again, the question lingers, where are the fragments? Perhaps the best clue to that might be answered from the events at Karankas. Mike Farmer and Robert Ward were worried that even arriving the day after the impact that they might not have any fragments of Karankas to pull out of the waterlogged hole that made it. Kulik arrived nearly 2 decades later and found promising holes in the swampy taiga, only to drain a single one of them and come up empty-handed. The taiga is not like a desert or an ice sheet, where meteorites are preserved and spotted from a distance. Forests with a wide variety of animals and plant life filled with muddy bogs make it easy for any rock that was once at the surface to slip into the mud. Even more, if this was a chondrite as delicate as the one at Karankas, It could have easily disintegrated in the wet landscape over the course of years. Top that off with the fact that even today, only a small handful of meaningful expeditions had ever been taken to reach the region, and not all of them were even looking for remnants of stone. Even Zlobin's three fragments, the only alleged possible pieces of Tunguska, were collected in the 1980s, not analyzed in any way until 2008, and has not yet since been chemically analyzed. The difficulty of reaching the region and truly inspecting it will at best result in controversial evidence on whether any meteorite fragments found at all were related to a meteor explosion over a century ago. But the most telling evidence may be the testimonials from Vannevera, less than 40 miles from the blast, where they said they felt that stones were raining down upon them from the blast. What are the chances that someone in the decades following the blast noticed a slightly different rock in the taiga? And what are the chances that even if it was noticed by some random evenk, why would they pick it up and keep it in a forest where there are infinite stones? And then, what are the chances that person would have run into Kulik 2 decades later and still have the rock? Most likely, a serious investigation into the region may turn up meteorite fragments. There was even one source that claimed, but did not provide evidence, that pieces of meteorite fragments were found embedded into the downed trees. But due to the remoteness of the location and the haphazard way information collection has gone in the region, it's likely that no definitive evidence of the Tunguska meteorite will ever be found. Thank you for listening to this episode of No Character Limit. Every episode, the sources that I used are located in the description if you would like to check them out. In addition, please consider liking, rating, and reviewing if you enjoyed this podcast, as each one goes to help further the reach of this podcast for new people to hear. Each episode requires hours in research, writing, recording, and editing. So if you feel that what you just heard is worth a donation of any size, please go to the description and follow the links for that. Each donation comes with a free PDF copy of a writing piece of your choice, no matter the size of your donation, and you get a lot of extra features with that, including a lot of the artwork and graphs and pictures, as well as the descriptions that I don't include in the podcast. If you would like updates for new episodes, you can follow No Character Limit at mastodon.world. And finally, if you have a question, comment, or even a correction, please feel free to reach out at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again for listening.